Greer versus Davis. Alright, Johnson.
May it please the court. My name is John Keene, and I represent Ernest Collier in this case. Mr. Collier is appealing the denial of his petition for a writ of habeas corpus. Your Honors, I want to emphasize 3 points about Mr. Collier's case. First, it was understood that James Merrill, the state's key witness, would definitely be prosecuted and likely convicted if he refused to testify against Mr. Collier.
Could we start right there?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because
absolutely.
My concern with your position is this. I'm perfectly willing to, entertain the thought that under Supreme Court decisions like Giglio and so on, you don't need a written piece of paper that says agreement before you have the kind of agreement or understanding that would qualify for the sort of impeachment evidence you're looking at. But there's another line of cases that also says the witness's unilateral hope or expectation of leniency isn't enough. It really does have to be a bilateral understanding between the agent of the state, whether it be, the police officer or the person in the prosecutor's office, etc. It's got to be on both sides. And we have testimony here from Prater and the prosecutors that there was simply no agreement or understanding or any other notion on their side that there would be this arrangement with Merrill. So in the face of that, even if you're right on the law, how does this outcome change?
Your Honor, you are correct that the hopeful expectation of a witness, a unilateral expectation, need not be disclosed. I mean, clearly the state wouldn't even know
that. It's an impossible burden for the state. How do they know?
I agree with you.
Yeah.
And in our brief, we argued two understandings. First, we argued that Merrill understood he wouldn't be prosecuted. The second, and the one I want to focus on here, is that he was threatened with prosecution. It is that that gave rise to the understanding that falls under Giglio.
But where do we have a notion that this was a shared understanding between Prater and Merrill?
Your Honor, I would submit that by arresting Merrill, by showing him witnesses who could place him at the scene of the crime, telling him to testify against Mr. Collier or actually confess to the crime himself, and finally, by threatening him with prosecution and saying, you can be convicted of this, that Prater understood what Merrill was going to anticipate.
So you're saying that all those actions, that there was an inference that he should have drawn. I mean, that somehow all these actions then meant that there was this understanding.
Indeed, Your Honor. In the language of Giglio, evidence of an understanding.
Yeah. And do you have any cases like this where you sort of look at the actions of the prosecutor or the law enforcement officer and they somehow add up to an understanding? Do you have any cases similar to this?
I found no such cases, Your Honor, other than Giglio itself,
mm-hmm.
in which the U.S. attorney actually threatened the witness with prosecution. The court termed that an understanding, and in its holding said evidence of any understanding or agreement as to a future prosecution. So we need not concern ourselves with an understanding for leniency, so to speak. Rather, this was an understanding of certain prosecution.
And the record does show that Mr. Merrill was never prosecuted for being an accessory to this murder or otherwise.
Indeed, Your Honor. He was.
What is your difference there between understanding and agreement?
Your Honor, I believe an understanding.
You're using it here.
I believe the term agreement, Your Honor, typically refers to an arrangement between the prosecution and a witness. in which it is clear that the witness will not be prosecuted.
And that's your feeling here that this was an agreement?
No, Your Honor. Perhaps there was one. I mean, we do know that the witness was not prosecuted. And the prosecution indeed has a duty to prosecute. So if there was no prosecution...
What do you mean he has a duty?
I believe that...
Doesn't every prosecutor have that discretion to determine if he is or he isn't going to prosecute?
I suppose, Your Honor.
Yeah. I suppose. And isn't the law very clear on that?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
So your argument is that this is an understanding and that the Supreme Court, when they put those two terms in the disjunctive, must have meant something for each term.
Other than an agreement. Exactly, Your Honor. And if I may address Your Honor's point, I don't rely on, Mr. Collier doesn't rely on an agreement in this case. We don't suggest that there definitely was some agreement not to prosecute. What we do say is that there was an understanding that Merrill would be prosecuted if he didn't testify. And that bears on his credibility at least as much as any explicit agreement. You know, that fear of prosecution.
In what detail was that gone into during the trial?
Your Honor, it was brought up in redirect examination, sort of what agreements had or arrangements had been made between Merrill and the prosecution. Merrill said he just didn't remember anything, and that was the extent of it. Mr. Collier's counsel at trial made a motion to produce in which he asked for exculpatory evidence. Nothing was given.
But did he cross-examine on that point in terms of what his expectations were, his hopes were? Did he get into that on cross? You said the government brought out on redirect.
That is true. He did not. And I submit, Your Honor, that he didn't know the answer to that question. And in fact, from all the evidence that he had, there was no understanding or agreement because everyone had told him otherwise.
There was no understanding or agreement.
At that point, Your Honor, that was the process.
Who's the he we're talking about right now?
We're talking about Mr. Collier's trial counsel.
Mr. Collier's trial counsel, having asked for exculpatory evidence from the prosecution, received none, didn't know that he was supposed to be asking about more.
Correct, Your Honor. And as the adage goes, don't ask about anything on cross-examination that you don't know the answer to.
Yeah.
He didn't know the answer, and he didn't ask.
But then, you know, actually, you might mention your position on some of the state's procedural default issues, too. Later on, I suppose, or at what point do we find out that Prater has this conversation with Merrill and Merrill is reporting these insinuations from Prater's side and so on?
We don't find that out until post-conviction relief in the state courts, Your Honor.
State post-conviction stage in Indiana.
That's correct, Your Honor. And Mr. Collier amended his post-conviction petition in the trial court to include the Brady claim.
Okay.
He then addressed it in both his brief to the Court of Appeals and in his petition to transfer to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, these understandings also were material to Collier's case, and specifically the understanding that he would be prosecuted if he didn't testify. It would have enabled Collier to impeach Merrill. And Merrill was the state key witness. He was really the only evidence linking Collier to the scene of this crime. Moreover, we have a statement of the prosecutor who actually prepared this case for trial. And he said Merrill's testimony was, quote, very material. And he also said he believed he couldn't get beyond a reasonable doubt without Merrill.
Did the appellant argue this theory in state court? The difference between agreement and understanding, and did he raise it in the state court?
Your Honor, in one situation, and you'll find that on page 164 of our appendix, or 30B appendix, the argument was raised that, quote, an understanding existed between the state and Merrill, and Giglio was in fact cited. So in post-conviction proceedings, this argument was made, perhaps not this clearly, but It was certainly
was it raised to the court?
Yes, I would submit yes, Your Honor. And if you would like, I can cite.
And what did the court rule?
The court didn't address it actually. It didn't talk about understandings at all. It always talked about promises and agreements.
Did the attorney then ask the court why they aren't addressing it?
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. This was in post-conviction proceedings.
Right.
I believe in the brief to the Court of Appeals. So as far as I know, it was not argued.
It was not raised in the state court.
Not at the trial level.
Right.
That's correct, Your Honor. It wasn't even known, actually, until post-conviction proceedings.
And what you're saying was it just wasn't addressed in the appellate decision, even though it was raised, state appellate decision.
That's correct, Your Honor. State post-conviction appellate decision.
Your time is almost up, Counsel. To your head.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I mean, do you want to save any time for rebuttal?
I have saved 2 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay,
if I may. You used one of them.
I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your
Honor.
Right.
Bye.
May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Creese, and I'm a Deputy Attorney General of Indiana, representing Superintendent Davis in this habeas appeal. The Indiana Court of Appeals properly determined under United States Supreme Court precedent that no agreement for Merrill's testimony was made by the state, and therefore no discovery by the state was required of any impeachment evidence. Moreover, even if there were an agreement, such an agreement would be immaterial in this case, given the facts and circumstances of the evidence presented at trial of Mr. Collier's guilt.
Mr. Creason, I don't want to talk about the materiality, although I have to say I think that's a troublesome point, but it seems to me there are two possibilities here. One of them is that the Indiana court didn't realize that the Supreme Court had created two categories that both count for Giglio, one understandings of a more informal nature, and the other, you know, actual agreements, which do exist frequently, you know, with between prosecutors and witnesses. Because it keeps using the word agreement, and it seems to me if it absolutely omits half of the test that the Supreme Court has established, then perhaps it has done something contrary to established Supreme Court precedent. If by the word agreement it really means, you know, anything that would count even in the weakest conspiracy case, you know, or something, you know, informal understandings, you're in a different situation. And I guess you also have a question, even if they made a mistake, even if they thought it had to be a formal agreement and they overlooked the possibility of informal agreements, if there isn't one on this record, then the mistake wouldn't make any difference. And so those are the kind of contours, at least of my thinking about this case, that I'm a little troubled by the fact that they're only using the word agreement, but I'm also interested in what the record shows as to what exactly went on between Prater and Merrill.
Let me discuss that a bit. Respectfully, I disagree with Mr. Collier's and to a certain extent, Your Honor's reading of the Indiana Court of Appeals opinion. It is true that they discuss agreement, and they don't discuss understandings.
I just said it's the only word they use.
Yes.
I mean, so we have to take it from there.
The Collier has made consistently an argument that there was never a written, concrete agreement that the state could disclose in a paper form. That isn't the type of agreement here. The only type of agreement was the sort of fluid understandings. And so the Indiana Court of Appeals, on this record, and on the briefs, that was what was discussed. That was what was briefed. That was the arguments made. I believe that it would be improper to
read. Fluid understanding you're talking about now?
As opposed to the sort of concrete agreement on paper, we will not prosecute you, we will seek to get other charges dismissed, whatever, in exchange for your testimony. The sort of agreement that is in.
In other words, there was a fluid understanding.
I'm sorry.
There was a fluid understanding?
No,
is that what you're telling us?
No. That is the argument that Collier has made throughout state court and throughout.
And what's your interpretation of what the record says?
The record does not support that. Mr. Collier.
Can I just clarify?
Why not, doesn't it?
Because the only evidence here is, first of all, Merrill's self-contradictory statements at trial and at post-conviction as to what he even understood there being. At trial, he didn't remember any statements made by Detective Prater, and he didn't remember any sort of agreement. And it's not until post-conviction, Mr. Collier's post-conviction, that he remembers something. But on direct examination, he testifies that Prater did not tell him he would not be prosecuted. And there was no quid pro quo, although that terminology was not used. And then on cross-examination, he wavers a little bit and says, no, I don't really think there was, but if there were, then it would have been something like, I will be prosecuted if I don't confess. That is all. There is not the second part, which is, we're not going to prosecute you if you do not confess. The state submits that the reason Mr. Merrill was not convicted, not charged, is there really wasn't enough evidence against him to go to trial. There was barely enough evidence without Merrill's testimony to place Collier at the scene. In fact, the only person
that does...
Which
is why I have problems with the materiality half of your argument. It's weak without Merrill placing Collier at the scene.
Not with the other circumstantial evidence of him being in the area in the same car with Merrill, asking, threatening...
I thought they put him in a house killing someone.
That is a somewhat different argument. We can get there in a minute. The prosecutors and Detective Prater testified that there was no agreement.
Testified?
There was no understanding. Excuse
the
me.
Prosecutor testified?
Yes.
At the post-conviction?
Yes. Two prosecutors testified. The first prosecutor who dealt with some pretrial matters, and he left the case before trial. And then the prosecutor who tried the case, who prepped the case for trial, and tried the case. They
right.
both testified.
I understand.
Both of them testified that there was no agreement, and they looked for an agreement, they examined the facts of the case, and there was no agreement, and they likely would have, the reason they wouldn't have had an agreement is because Mr. Merrill was not a particularly cooperative witness, and they had troubles finding him. He had to be arrested on a probation violation just before trial, and that's how they compelled his attendance at trial. And that they said they would have revoked a deal if there was a deal. And Detective Prater testified that it would not be in his normal course of investigation to have made the sort of statements suggesting a deal with Merrill, that was not the way he did business, so to speak. However, he did say that, I believe that his testimony says, he would likely have explained to Merrill that there was evidence against him and that the state would likely seek charges against him, but that was not his decision, and he could not discuss whether or not charges would be brought, merely that they likely would be, given the investigation thus far. The unilateral, as Your Honor pointed out, the unilateral expectations of a witness are not enough to establish an agreement. In this case, we don't even have evidence that there was, that the unilateral expectation was even there, because he contradicts himself so many times, it's just not reliable. The post-conviction court did not believe that there was an agreement under the terms of Giglio. The Indiana Court of Appeals agreed, given the evidence that Mr. Collier has been able to develop thus far in the case.
So would it be your position then that both of those decisions don't really deal with, because the understanding is not in any of either of those opinions, right? Understanding,
yes,
as we're discussing it today, is not in those opinions.
Yes. The word understanding does not appear in either the post-conviction court's findings of fact, conclusions of law, or the Indiana Court of Appeals opinion. However,
what in the finding of facts would preclude them saying understanding? In other words, they don't consider it as an understanding at all. Is there anything in the fact the facts just rule out any kind of agreement, period?
Yes. Our position is the facts rule out a concrete agreement and an understanding. The facts don't establish either one. And the Indiana Court of Appeals, under these facts, had to understand that. It is unfortunate that they were not more clear. and I wish that they had been. It would have eliminated some problems. But that does not necessarily mean that it is contrary to Giglio or any other of the Brady precedent. And if I may, the unreasonable application standard has been waived in this case because Mr. Collar has not asserted that it was an unreasonable application of Brady and his progeny, merely that this decision was contrary to Giglio. As, if I may briefly address the materiality arguments, petitioner...
Meet it up.
Oh, my time has expired.
Well, that's right. All right. Take half a minute.
Oh, well, thank you, Your Honor. Defendant misunderstands what materiality means. Materiality is not whether or not without this witness the case would be able to be made, because that assumes that the credibility of Merrill would have been devastated by an evidence of an agreement. But he was vigorously cross-examined, and in fact, a prior burglary conviction had been brought out. And some inconsistent statements between his trial testimony and his statements to police. And the many, many witnesses who placed Collier threatening different people's lives with a handgun, asking where the victim lived, and in the same car, his mother's car, and even confessing to a friend that he had killed someone that day, renders the jury's verdict reliable in this case, and we ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you, counsel. All right. Counsel?
Your Honor, with respect to the understanding first, as Your Honor pointed out, perhaps the courts didn't realize that there was this second part to Giglio. That, in fact, is why their decision was contrary to Giglio. They simply failed to apply it, and that is why we did not argue unreasonable application.
But Mr. Creason says that this more informal kind of understanding was the only evidence of agreement that they were even considering. So how could they have been speaking more formally if that's the case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat that?
I at least understood Mr. Creason to be saying that in the briefs and so on, in the presentation to the Indiana courts in post-conviction proceedings, that no one was saying there was a formal written agreement, that the court was being asked to find the kind of informal understanding that you're now talking about.
The court was asked to find, indeed, not a written agreement, but an informal understanding that Merrill would not be charged, which
right.
is different
and
than...
So in other words, they understood that they were actually in the more informal half of Giglio.
Yes, Your Honor. Informal, yes, but not the understanding part. An agreement, I believe, can be informal.
Okay.
It need not be in writing. What we're arguing here is an informal understanding that that Merrill would definitely be charged.
I'll give you 30 seconds more, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, with respect to materiality, two points that the state has mentioned. First, Collier, the state had no evidence that Collier asked where the witness lived, and we mentioned that in our brief, but I do want to emphasize it. The evidence he refers to is testimony by by Mr. Wills, Corey Wills. Mr. Wills, ultimately on cross-examination, admits that he didn't hear that at all. And apparently that maybe somebody else told him, we don't know. It never got that far. But what we do know is that he was not party to a conversation in which Mr. Collier asked about where Mr. McGuire lived. And second, that no one else, he didn't hear Mr. Collier talking to anybody else about that. And finally, Mr. Collier never admitted to killing someone to a friend of his. What he did say was that, according to one of the state's witnesses, Collier mentioned to her that the police thought he had shot someone. Didn't admit to killing anybody, could have been referring to anything, and we don't know what weight the jury would have given that evidence without Merrill's testimony, without Merrill's credible testimony. Your Honors, Giglio required disclosure of this understanding, and we believe it was material. So Mr. Collier asked that you vacate his murder conviction and order that he either be released or, in the alternative, granted a new trial.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will proceed to case number 5, please. Harris.